we have a vision for what an internet financial system can look like. We have a vision for what open, programmable, composable money can bring to the world and the innovation of that and the open internet and what that makes possible. And we want to make sure that that can come to life and not be stifled. And that does require policymakers and governments to actually create more degrees of freedom for innovation to happen, as has happened in other major areas of the internet.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. A business is only as strong as its people, and every hire matters. Go to linkedin.com/twist to post your first job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Google Cloud. Accelerate your startup journey with the Google for Startups Cloud program. Get up to 200K in Google Cloud credits or up to 350K for AI startups, plus training and guidance. Apply at startups.google.com/twist. And Beehive. Power your newsletters with AI tools, referral programs, and ad network features, all in one platform. Get 30 days free and 20% off your first 3 months at beehive.com/twist.
Welcome back to This Week in Startups. My name is Alex. I'm Alex over on X or Twitter, if you want to call it that. Today, we have a very special guest, one that I've been looking forward to talking to for some time. Now, I've been covering crypto since 2013, 2014, somewhere in there, back when Bitcoin was either double or triple digits, if you want to know how far back that was. And a question that has always come up is, what will be the killer use case for crypto? Some people said store of value. Some people really leaned into trading. I think that the union of those two things is the real thing that crypto is going to unlock for the world, and that is stablecoins. So today on the podcast, we have Jeremy Allaire back. Jeremy is the co-founder, CEO, and chairman of Circle. Jeremy, hey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Alex. It's awesome to be here. Excited for the conversation.
Yeah, so before the show, we were talking about the ancient past, the 90s, if you will, and the era of the internet that brought us into the 2000s. You founded a company called Allaire that made Cold Fusion. Tell us about how you took that company and ended up the CTO of Macro Media.
Yeah, absolutely. So just, going way back in time, just even before I founded that company, I got involved in the internet in 1990. And the thing that got me interested in this was I experienced firsthand the sort of power of open networks, distributed and decentralized networks, open protocols, open source software. This is sort of what I like to refer to as like the DNA of the internet. And I experienced that as I was looking at, you know, what was happening with the collapse of the Soviet Union. I was sort of studying that. And I basically, you know, I went very deep on technology and became convinced that like this would be transformative to the world. And then in 1994, as the very first like graphical web browser technology emerged, it became really clear like, okay, we now have like a piece of software that you could render content and applications and other things into, which led to this concept of sort of the web as an application platform. And so with my brother and others, we co-founded Allaire, which built, as you noted, Cold Fusion. And Cold Fusion came out in January of 1995. And it was the first commercial web programming language. There were some things like Perl, if you remember Perl, people would write C code behind web servers to like make things dynamic in web browsers. But Cold Fusion really made it easy and accessible to anyone who had an idea and like $1,000 to build an interactive application you could deliver through a browser. And that was a really big concept in 1995. And that like took off, and we rode the whole wave of people building websites, e-commerce, bringing content online. We had literally with the whole family of tools that we built out, we had millions of developers using our software. And then as that market matured, like we took the company public in early 1999, we were unfashionable because we were profitable. Most companies going public in the dot-com era were not profitable at all, but it was good, but we were kind of an arms supplier to the whole internet 1.0 revolution. And then after we went public, we merged with Macro Media, which was also a huge provider of tools for building the internet, building the web, building content, and so on. And I became the chief technology officer of that combined company and then helped pioneer, the use of Flash, which we all probably remember as like a very powerful piece of software for doing deeper forms of media, communications, interactivity over the internet. And that was back in 2001. So going back quite some time.
I mean, we outgrew Flash, but I do think Flash gets a bad rap in retrospect. Like, we used it for a really long time. Flash was great until we, had better stuff. But I feel like there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about the demise of Flash that I don't think is entirely fair.
I know a lot about it. Yeah.
So this is a little bit of a layup for you, but, you know, given your conversation about the internet, open protocols, decentralization, what brought you from the end of your time at Macromedia to 2013 when you decided that, hey, we need to found Circle, we need to start working on the stablecoin issue? I presume that there's some ideological kind of like parallels between those two points.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you go back to sort of what brought me into the internet in the first place, I was actually studying international political economy. I was sort of looking at kind of comparative economic systems, political systems. I was very interested in sort of international economic systems, stuff like that. I got, excited about the internet, got excited about sort of the transformation of these open networks and what that could do for information and information distribution and software distribution. And that was sort of led there. And then actually, it was at Macromedia where, we back in, it was 22 years ago, we put a seamless way to play video into Flash Player in March of 2002. And we basically made like video playback ubiquitous on the internet. And we kind of made it for the first time, it was like easy for anyone to like put video into a browser. And that led to the development of YouTube, which exploded. That was all built on Flash Player video. And that also led me to found a company, Brightcove, which basically was taking, again, these fundamental DNA of the internet, open networks, open protocols, distributed systems. And my idea was, well, we could basically enable any company, any media company to directly distribute video and television on the internet. And, back in 2004, right, we had just started getting broadband. We had just started getting Wi-Fi. We didn't really have mobile devices yet, but there were all this talk about connected devices. And it was very clear, I could see how, we're going to have all these connected devices. We're going to have Wi-Fi and mobile broadband, and that's going to unleash video in a way that wasn't possible. So built up a kind of online television distribution system, online video platform. That was kind of a continuation of sort of, okay, there's now new stuff you can do on the internet. It's richer, it's fuller, it's sort of more true to things people thought during the .com era would be possible, actually became possible in Web 2 when you had these sort of more technology proliferation that was better. And that was a very successful business and grew, and we IPO'd Brightcove in early 2012. So we sort of grew it to that point. And so here's sort of getting to the answer to the question, which is when the financial crisis hit in 2008 and 2009, that significantly stimulated my earlier interests were my earlier kind of academic interests. And I sort of became an armchair political economist. And so I found myself reading a huge amount about the nature of money, central banking, the international monetary system, the nature of fractional reserve banking, all this stuff. I became really interested because I was how did this happen? And is there a better way forward? Is there a better way to build the international monetary system? And, it's not the kind of thing where, you sort of wake up one day and say, I'm going to create a startup to, transform the international monetary and economic system. It's not, it's not a typical thing that you just decide to do. So at that time, 2009, 2010, I didn't do that because there wasn't a clear path to do that. It was more just, I'm interested in this. And then in 2012, actually, not long after I took Brightcove public, I came across crypto and went down the rabbit hole and got very excited about the technology. And I am a technologist, I'm a product guy, and I kind of looked at it from a technology first perspective. And I saw several things. I was like, wow, this is actually a technical breakthrough. There are problems, there are computer science problems that have been solved here that are really powerful. And the first time I synchronized the blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain onto my laptop and was able to conduct a transaction using that directly over the internet, that was like the NCSA Mosaic moment for me. It was like, oh my God, this direct infrastructure where you can safely and provably conduct a transaction directly with a counterparty over an open source protocol on the internet. It's like, wow, this is a breakthrough. This is a missing, it's a fundamental missing piece of the internet. And the more that my co-founder and I dug in, the more that, and in particular into like the technical community, there were a lot of people in the technical community of crypto back then who were really jazzed about ideas like, how could you use this tech to not just have Bitcoin, but issue other types of now we call them digital assets or digital tokens on these networks. And, you know, I had built virtual machines and helped build programming languages and stuff in the past, as we just talked about. And so there was discussion of how could you make these types of digital assets programmable? How could you have programmable money? How could you have smart contracts? And these were like ideas on napkins for a lot of people. There were a couple of white papers and stuff, but it was very clear that all those things would happen. And we could see very clearly how all those things would happen. We didn't know the exact time frame, but we knew that those would happen. And when we looked at all that, and I kind of merged that with my thinking about like, how do you build a safer financial system? And how do you build a more open financial system? All this like converged. And I became basically, it's all I could think about, totally obsessed, and obviously decided to found Circle. And, you know, the basic idea, and it goes back to something we were talking about before we started the show. The basic idea was, can we create like an HTTP for money? Can we create a protocol for dollars on the internet that is open, programmable, et cetera? And that was the idea, you know, 10, 11 years ago. And now we've done it. Like it's here and it's happening. And as you introduced, right, it's sort of killer app of crypto, and it's really starting to take off. But it took a long time to build it. But now it's quite a significant scale, but yet still very early.
Founders, I know that you're keeping a close eye on your burn rate. I am too. In today's venture market, every single hire you make has to be perfect, right? You can't make mistakes. You got to keep that runway as long as possible so that you can run more experiments. And you need talented people to run those experiments and figure out how you're going to get product market fit, how you're going to scale your company. And that's why you need to use LinkedIn Jobs. As you know, LinkedIn brings you the candidates that you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn passed the 1 billion member mark. Think about that, 1 billion members. And 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit the other leading job sites. This is a phenomenal statistic. They don't even go to the other job sites. Why? Because they might not be looking, and those are the best hires, but they're hanging out on LinkedIn, doing professional development, checking in on their network, building their network, sharing content, finding leads, all that great stuff. Bottom line, there's amazing hires waiting for your company on LinkedIn and nowhere else. And they have a special deal right now. Post a job for free. What? F-R-E-E. What a great price. LinkedIn.com/twist. That's right. LinkedIn.com/T-W-I-S-T to post your job for free. Terms and conditions, of course, apply.
So thinking about the moment that we saw Bitcoin reach the more broader technological consciousness, and then stablecoins today, I see a bit of a gap between them. And I know this is perhaps me being an old fuddy-duddy, but when I think about Bitcoin, programmable money, and reforming the world's financial and economic systems, it seems a little bit strange that we've ended up at a place where the coolest and most hot thing on the blockchain is digital dollars, and we'll get to it in a minute, digital euros. Is there a tension between the desire for decentralization and more transparency, and then stablecoins having, you know, themselves tied to existing fiat currencies?
I think, you know, my view, and this has been the sort of Circle path since we started, was this concept of a kind of hybrid system where if we want to move to a world where a huge percentage of the money that's stored, like the stored value, and where, you know, economic transactions and economic coordination, all kinds of economic coordination, not just payments, but like more complex forms of contractual coordination, where more and more of these things are happening on the internet natively, on chain, as people like to say. If we want to get to that world, we have to start from the world we have, right? And we have, you know, the dollar is the strongest currency in the world. The dollar, and you could say, hey, there's $34 trillion of debt, and, you know, the U.S. government could maybe like fall over paying its debts, or it's overextended, or it's, you know, take the Ray Dalio argument about these sort of these long running cycles, and are we in a decline cycle? And like, that's legitimate discourse. Like I firmly believe that's very legitimate discourse. But like from a here and now perspective, most people in the world want a network that effectively gives them a stable unit of account and gives them a powerful, technologically and utility-wise, powerful medium of exchange. And I think, you know, dollars themselves and digital dollars specifically are really, really a powerful and preferred medium. And so that's a starting point. And we need it rooted in like real dollars. That's why the way we've designed USDC is sort of, you know, getting as close as we possibly can to like government obligation money. And, you know, kind of this fully reserved. So people who hold are like, wow, okay, this isn't as risky as a bank deposit. This is like, you know, T-bills and like, and basically, you know, cash that's held with the safest custodians in the world. And like that, that's, you know, for the people who really drill in, they can see, wow, this is ultra safe dollar money. And it has all this utility on the internet. And that is highly useful. And it is a hybrid world because we are, you know, Circle is a centralized regulated entity. The protocols of public blockchains are open network protocols. The USDC protocol and the CCTP protocol, these protocols, these are open public permissionless protocols that developers can build on, that end users can connect to. And there's these vast ecosystems of startups and enterprises and big companies that are connecting to these protocols in the same way that people connected to HTTP. And so you have this kind of hybrid model. You get the benefits of this like public internet infrastructure, and you get the sort of reliability, certainty, compliance, legality of a digital dollar that's sort of anchored in its core in the existing dollar system. And then providing that interoperability layer so that, you know, you want that interoperability layer. A lot of people, you probably remember this when like Skype came out, like it was like, wow, I can't believe it. I can have free phone calls on the internet. Amazing. Obviously, we use all kinds of stuff for that now. But like, you know, for a while, it was like really important that like you had interoperability. You could use like Skype out. If you remember, Skype out was like, I can use my Skype to like get on a regular connect to the legacy phone system, right? It's not quite the same analogy, but it's similar here in that like you want interoperability. You want basically the ability to like come on and off chain very, very seamlessly and easily all around the world.
Yeah, I had in my notes, is Circle a TradFi company or a crypto company? I tried to answer that question while prepping for our chat today, and I ended up having no answer to it. So I'm glad you think that it's hybrid, because that makes me feel better about not being able to put the company into one camp in particular. I do want to go back just a little bit to the point about reserves and so forth. I'd looked into the funds that you guys hold through your main BlackRock fund, if you will.
Reserve fund, yep.
Exactly. By the way, I do love that in the SEC filings, it's like, who can purchase this? Not you, just Circle. Kind of cool to have your own fund. But if you go through the reserves, apart from just standard bank balances, you guys do hold an enormous amount of U.S. federal debt.
Yeah.
And when we think about the euro stablecoin, EURC, which has seen some pretty impressive growth lately, does that mean that Circle is going to hold the underlying backing assets for the euro stablecoin in EU and euro denominated debts as well?
Yeah. So the European stablecoin laws actually affect both USDC and EURC. And so July 1st, we announced that we were the first global stablecoin issuer to have both a dollar stablecoin, USDC, and a euro stablecoin, EURC, legal electronic money in the European Union and issued and made available in the European Union itself. So it's both dollars and euros that are under that regime. We're the only major company and global player with a dollar stablecoin that is actually legally compliant now there. But specifically to your question, the laws kind of prescribe, you know, the kind of safety of the reserves and what you need to do. And euro needs to be held in euro cash, or it can be held in basically like the highest rated European government bond. So think of it as German T-bills or French T-bills, right? Bundesbonds, for example.
Jeremy, that's Italy erasure. Come on.
I'm just telling you, what are the highest rated, you know, government bonds? And so some portion, a meaningful portion of the reserves can be held that way. Now, EURC is new, it's growing, but it's, you know, we're not at the stage where we have that sort of same exact structure as USDC, but we're optimistic about the potential for Euro stablecoin and of course will evolve to ensure, obviously it has to be legally compliant, but we do have the ability to kind of, you know, have a similar structure to USDC.
All right, everybody, you know, being at a startup is a team sport. You're not going to get there alone, man. You got your founders, you got the early team members, of course, investors, most importantly, that first couple of customers, right? And you all work together to get your company off the ground. And I have great news for you and your team. Google for Startups Cloud Program is now a partner here at This Week in Startups. And listen, you all just want to know the number. Here's the number, 200,000. 350,000. These are the two numbers. What are these two numbers? You're going to get $200,000 in Google Cloud credits. And if you're an AI startup, you can get up to $350,000. Google is serious. Google for Startups Cloud Program is here on This Week in Startups. Just letting you know, they are serious about helping your startup. The number is the number, okay? And there's two great numbers here. 90% of generative AI unicorns choose Google Cloud. We all know that. They do a great job. So here's your call to action. You need to get these credits. You need to start building. You're going to find out everything about this amazing program, Google Startup Cloud Program, at startups.google.com/twist. Okay, very simple. Hit the rewind key, bookmark this, write it down. I want you to sign up right now. Pause the podcast because these are big numbers, folks. They really want to support you. I don't know how long they're going to do this for. So startups.google.com/twist. All right, let's get back to this amazing program.
All right, let's talk about the state of stablecoins as a market. You and I are both Token Terminal fans on Twitter, and they had a really excellent set of charts that shows four critical data points here. One is upper left is outstanding supply, total stablecoins in circulation, nearly back to an all-time high if I'm reading that chart correctly. But the charts that really stood out to me was the number of stablecoin holders, the amount of transfers, and how quickly things are moving around. It seems that all the charts right now for stablecoins are up and to the right, almost at an accelerating pace. So, Jeremy, why is this moment proving so fecund for the stablecoin market?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, over the years, and I would say even, say, 2 years ago, a year ago, you know, people are always asking, like, you know, what does it take for this to achieve, like, mainstream scale, right? And you know, my answer has typically been there's sort of three key things that we need to solve, right? And by we, I don't just mean Circle. I'm sort of like collectively, like all of us together trying to figure out how to solve this. One of those is infrastructure. So the infrastructure, the blockchain networks themselves, and my mental model for these blockchain networks is these are internet operating systems. And basically, we need higher performance, higher throughput internet operating systems, these blockchain networks. And so that's been a big jump. Over the past couple of years, we've firmly moved into the sort of third generation of blockchain networks through high performance layer one blockchains and these layer twos. And what that effectively means is that you can do higher throughput, and the transaction costs for per transaction are either sub a cent or a penny or whatever. And so, you know, this is, you know, Brian Armstrong tweets about, you know, sub-second, sub-penny transactions, like we're there, right? And, you know, there are these high-performance networks, and that is contributing to that growth because, you know, you bring the unit costs down, the marginal costs down, you make the throughput higher. It's sort of like going from dial-up to broadband and Web 1.0 to Web 2.0. We're kind of going through that infrastructure upgrade, and that's unleashing more utility. Now, the second thing is that stablecoin networks like USDC are network effect businesses. They are platforms that people build on, meaning developers build apps to integrate to the protocol. And the more apps that are integrated, the more utility the network has, the more people who have the digital asset, the more utility the network has. And so you have these kind of positive network effect models. And then the more that happens, the more the developers say, hey, like, I'm at a competitive disadvantage if I'm building a product if I don't support USDC. And so you have the infrastructure upgrades. You have these really interesting both user and developer network effects that are starting to really take hold. And then, you know, you also have like what I'll call like real usability improvements. And it's part of the infrastructure upgrade. You know, you probably remember, you know, just even 2-3 years ago, right? You know, to use a stablecoin, you need to like go buy it somewhere. And then you needed to like go get like a browser plugin, and the browser plugin, you needed to, in order to use it, you needed to buy like Ethereum, and like that cost a bunch, and there's like fees, and then like takes you like 7 minutes to transfer the Ethereum to your self-custody wallet. And like, it's just like completely nonsense. And so it would be like totally justified for someone to say like, who in the right mind is going to use this? But now, you know, you literally through web-based interfaces and mobile app interfaces, you can onboard into a wallet with like the onboarding experience of like onboarding to like WhatsApp with a mobile ID, a passkey, a face ID, like these kinds of things. It's secure, and you don't have to remember seed phrases and all this jazz. And you can, you know, the what I like to call the on and off ramps, which is sort of the way in which you can kind of get from the, you know, existing, you know, money system into the on-chain system is much, much easier and getting better. And so all of that combined is creating conditions that allow it to be easier to adopt and use stablecoins. And sort of the final boss in all of this is the government. And so what we're really, I think what's really exciting is that all around the world, almost every major jurisdiction, from Japan to Hong Kong to Singapore to all of Europe, the UK, UAE, and the United States, all these jurisdictions are putting in place laws and regulations that define stablecoins as legal electronic money and a part of the real world financial system. And so as those laws happen, then that really opens up the universe beyond the crypto early adopters to everyone. And so, like, I think by the end of 2025, we believe that like stablecoins will be a legal integrated part of the financial system, like pretty much really broadly. And so it's why I also think those charts are great and they're fun to look at. And we're excited about that. But, we also recognize like it's still super early days when you think about how large this phenomenon can be. Because we're kind of like in the crossing the chasm metaphor, Jeffrey Moore's kind of thing. I think we're kind of like midair trying to leap over the chasm right now. We have not crossed the chasm. Things could still go bad and we could plummet. But I think we're going to make the leap.
Okay. I want to get to the future currencies point in a second, but on the wallets point, I do think that the user interface for crypto writ large has gotten so much better over the last 10, 15 years, but also in the last couple of years, to your point. Is there a time in the future that you can see when I have, okay, let's just say a Citibank account and I have a debit card and I want to go purchase something and it's a USDC transaction and Citibank could effectively mediate between my checking account balance of dollars and to digital dollars that it might have for its own kind of swapping purposes. And I can use a trad card in a USDC transaction without needing to have a stablecoin account or MetaMask account or Coinbase account, whatever. And I can just use what I have and not even know that I've switched from regular dollars to digital dollars.
So there's a lot in that question. I think there's a lot of things happening simultaneously that align with what you're describing. So on the one hand, we are seeing more and more what I'll broadly call like the fintech forward banks, or like the what are often called neobanks, right? More and more of these firms that are just adding directly the ability to use stablecoins. And so whether that's Nubank in Latin America, or that's Revolut in Europe, or, you know, a kind of brokerage app like a Robinhood, obviously, you know, in some ways, you know, some of these huge crypto firms like Coinbase and Binance that have like 400 million users combined, Those are like kind of financial super apps increasingly, where you can hold a balance, you can take your paycheck, you can have a card attached to it, you can do these things, and they make it seamless to get USDC and stuff like that. So we're seeing, you know, more and more of this ability to store value in what you would think of as dollars. It is USDC. And actually, you know, we work with both Visa and MasterCard today, and they have programs in place where a card issuer, so someone's issuing like a Visa card or a MasterCard, those card issuers can issue a card where the money that is being spent is actually stablecoin. And so you're spending USDC. And there's a big proliferation of these, especially in emerging markets. We're seeing all these products launch with they're basically like the neobanking style digital wallet apps that have a card, and it lets you use stablecoin as your way to store value, because people want to hold dollars. And then you spend it in the existing card network rails, and it settles using USDC. So like those card issuers can actually settle the funds that they owe to Visa or MasterCard actually using USDC itself. So like it's actually being used as a settlement rail for between the financial institution and the card networks. So that's an interesting thing that's happening on that side. On the other side, we're seeing like merchant acquirers. So, you know, the Worldpays of the world, you know, the checkout.coms of the world, the Nuvays of the world, the Stripes of the world, offering options for settlement on the merchant side in USDC. So we're seeing, yeah. So actually one of the coolest things that we saw earlier this year was John Collison at their big annual conference got up and did his kind of one more thing thing. And he basically said, hey, look, you know, crypto's back, but it's USDC and it's stablecoins. And he demoed basically like in the Stripe checkout product, which they're rolling out. It's like the product that you could just add as a merchant to your website or your app or whatever. In the Stripe checkout product, like USDC payment acceptance will be right there alongside card payment acceptance. And he was really excited about it and talked about it. There's a video of him on Twitter you can see. And he basically, you know, shows like, hey, you can now settle. Look how easy this is. You can have instant settlement on Solana, they demoed, with USDC. The money arrives to the merchant instantly, and the fees are much lower. And, you know, he sort of made a comment like, this is how like payments should work. And so we're starting to see these sort of connection points, again, the hybrid model, these connection points that are there. And I do think that precisely to your question, as the kind of legal status of this becomes more clear, that more and more financial institutions will sort of say, hey, yeah, I'm going to use this as like a settlement layer. Because it's a very powerful way to do that. And it could be like a business says, hey, I'll take USDC because I get the money instantly and it's lower fees, like good for me, the business. And then on the other side, there's more and more of these end user products, whether it's a traditional bank, a neobank, a crypto, a super app, like these different types of apps, where it's a seamless experience to scan a QR code. And as I tweeted about earlier this year, like iOS opening up NFC to third-party wallets is a really big deal. And that will enable, Web3 wallets that have USDC. In theory, it'll enable them to do tap to pay, right? So you can actually use your phone with a wallet with USDC to make a transaction to a merchant at a point of sale. Other people have to do stuff. The processors, the acquirers have to like enable blockchain transactions. You know, the wallet developers themselves need to upgrade their wallets to add NFC tech, and they need to get approved by Apple. And like, there's a number of things that need to happen, but these are all things that are kind of in the 2025 horizon, which is pretty cool.
Okay, everybody, you know, I love newsletters. I love sharing knowledge and what I'm up to through my newsletter. And if you've got a newsletter, you got to check out Beehive. It's spelled B-E-E-H-I-I-V. I use it for the Twist ticker and our Twist 500 newsletter. My team is raving about Beehive because it is an all-in-one platform that not only powers our newsletter, but it's got all these incredible platform features that are helping us grow our subscriber base, which is what these newsletters are about. Listen to this. Beehive's co-founder is the same person who helped Morning Brew reach millions of subscribers. In other words, they took all those tactics and they put it into a platform. They've got a great feature. I just want to tell you about it. It's called the AI Post Builder. This makes writing easy. As a great writer, sometimes I need inspiration. Well, they will get inputs for your ideas and then shape and optimize your content for the maximum impact. It's perfect for busy founders, right? And they're available 24 hours a day. They also have a referral program that turns your audience into ambassadors. It works great. Plus, hey, if you want to monetize, they got an ad network. And you know what? It's super affordable, starting just at $39 a month. So here's a great call to action. 30-day free trial, plus 20% off your first 3 months. Go to beehive.com/twist, beehive.com/twist, BEEHIIV.com. What a great product.
A question that keeps coming up in my mind as I listen to you is, who are you making mad? Because you're disrupting something. You're not disrupting the dollar. You're actually, I think, strengthening the dollar by helping it become digital.
Absolutely.
Buying U.S. government debt. Similar thing in Europe. But, you know, if I was the leader of a country that had a less stable currency and my citizens were trying to offload their local assets for dollars, which they now can do with USDC, do you run into people telling you to get lost from their national borders?
Well, within the international financial system, right, you have a lot of different currencies, obviously. There's hundreds, literally. And you have a lot of different kind of approaches to, in the traditional system, how money is allowed to move. And in some big markets, you have very strict laws and capital controls, like China and India, right? Those are the two biggest examples. And, you know, you don't see us going to China trying to drive USDC. We can't do that. It's not.
That would be funny, but it wouldn't work. Yeah.
No. And so in many parts of the world, you have what are called, you know, free floating currencies, and you have kind of open currency exchange, and there's no restrictions on, you know, a person holding different types of currencies. And so huge parts of the world, that is the case. But I think it'll be very interesting. I do think that this is an area where it's certainly going to be complex from a policy and political perspective. I think I like to refer to, you know, stable coins as over the top money. Like we had over
OTT
the top
money. Yeah.
Yeah. OTT money. It's like OTT media, OTT communications, OTT software distribution, like all this stuff, like the internet kind of let you do this. And so stable coins are like OTT money. You know, Netflix is OTT television, but like, you know, different countries have different laws about what Netflix can and can't do. And so we will have to navigate that, and we are. And so in what's actually happening is more and more countries are actually putting stablecoin laws on the books. And they're figuring out like, okay, well, here's how a foreign issued stablecoin like USDC is going to be allowed to work in our country. And, you know, the intermediaries within those countries that are allowed to be distributors or providers, and what are the reporting requirements and other things. So there are going to be laws that react to this, but at the same time, right, there's utility, there's like the raw utility that exists and end user preference. And I've said this in the past, like I think increasingly over the next decade, people everywhere will be able to vote with their smartphones what economic system they want to participate in. And that is going to create complex issues, but I do think that That is a path that will emerge.
It's going to be ultimately very, very good for open systems. I think that
I think so.
That'll go well.
Open internet wins. I mean, that's sort of my thesis from 30 years ago. Open internet wins, right?
I mean, look. If you, as you said earlier, we're looking at the Soviet style economy. What was one of the problems? Yeah. Well, it was information. You can't essentially plan unless you have all the information. They couldn't Absolutely. Get that by definition. Ergo, everything was out of whack at all times. So I think you and I share a transparency leads to efficiency argument.
Yes.
I wonder what will happen when, I don't know, BRICS countries, for example, you know, opt out of this because they want to have stricter capital controls and so forth. I mean, they're going to end up isolated not only from digital money writ large, but also I just think from an economic system that is experimenting in a way that really helps people escape what you might call bad economic geography derived luck. Like, I was born in the U.S. I had dollars my whole life.
Right.
Good fortune.
Right. It poses significant questions for governments over time. And my own belief is that, like, it just seems inevitable over the coming decades that there'll be, like, because of the internet, because of digital currency, because of the proliferation of this technology, it's likely that there will be fewer major international currencies. There already are very few major international currencies. You look at that in the trade flow data and sort of what happens in trade flow, right? But I think even all the way down to the kind of domestic use, right? I think that there will end up being fewer. And that ultimately can be very, very positive for economic development. It can be very, very positive for financial stability. It can be very, very positive. But it will require some difficult choices for countries around the world. And even in the US government itself, like the Treasury Department or the US government, they don't necessarily want to have like their economic policy decisions, which they're mandated to make for the domestic US population. Now, all of a sudden, they're like, oh, now we need to think about the Argentinians, or now we need to think about this. That is already the case. Like, interest rates follow the Fed, and we're effectively exporting our inflation or exporting our cost of money. And it already happens that way, what's called the Triffin dilemma in monetary theory. That exists for a reserve currency. But I do think that these issues will drive towards more consolidation in currencies over time.
We are going to get to interest rates in just a couple of seconds. I want to talk about Circle's business model and then also its history through SPACs, IPO filing, and so forth. But sticking just to the currencies and blockchains point, I think there are 15 supported blockchains for USDC today. You guys have the 16 dollar. Now. Your website led me astray. This is what happens when things are moving quickly. 16 blockchains. I apologize, Jeremy.
That's right.
You're fine. The dollar stablecoin, the euro stablecoin. I guess maybe the right question is there a time in the next couple of years when it's 10 currencies and 50 blockchains, or is it going to be more like 4 currencies and 20 blockchains? How much more do those numbers go up in the near term?
Yeah, so a couple things. I think first I'll talk about blockchains themselves. So
sure.
While to some people they might say, hey, EVMs have won and it's layer one, layer twos, super chains, all this stuff like that's like done. I don't agree with that. What I see, and I use my mental model on this is mobile, which is, and you can remember this well, pre-iPhone, there were like 17 different mobile operating systems. There was the Symbian operating system, Windows Phone, remember, Palm Pilot, BlackBerry, NTT Docomo, you had tons of these different. And everyone was trying to get developers to say, build on this and get their handsets distributed and all this stuff. And it was all awful. Like, none of it was any good.
Windows Mobile was trash. Yeah.
It was all trash. Like, and people were like, you go to Mobile World Congress and it was like, and they people would be showing off their, like, the, what they did with their Symbian 60 or whatever. And it was just awful. Right. So one could argue in some ways, like, as it being frank, right, like blockchain experiences and like the usability of blockchains and like the capabilities of blockchains, like up until more or less now, like has been kind of awful, right? It's sort of like, here's this incredible, these are like operating systems. They're competing for capabilities, developers, end user capabilities, friendliness, et cetera. And I would very clearly say we have not yet achieved an iPhone moment of blockchain networks themselves.
Wait, I want to push back on that, because Base, which is associated with Coinbase, has been growing incredibly quickly, and I follow a lot of folks who build on crypto, and I keep seeing more and more notes about Base. And so to me, in my head, I was questioning, is this the kind of like iPhone moment? Faster, cheaper, integrated, backed well by a major company. So that was my impression. I don't think you're trying to say that it's not the iPhone moment, but you seem to think that we still aren't there yet. Is that fair?
Well, there's so much still to be done. Meaning like, and by the way, we're huge fans of Base. We have like all, our products are supporting Base, and Coinbase is a key strategic partner in USDC. And so like it is great, and it's amazing what they've achieved. And like, I'm constantly retweeting cool stuff that they're doing and stuff. So it's really good. But like, we need to be in a world where blockchain networks are not just supporting financial transactions, they're supporting social games, content, intellectual property. They're supporting provenance of data for AIs. They're supporting, you know, AI agent transaction flows. They're supporting retail scale applications, you know, digital tokens that are used in like super large mainstream application utilities, right? All this stuff. You can't do that today. You can't do it. Like the throughput's not there. Everything falls over. So we're not scalable in that sense. We need to be able to get to millions of transactions per second on these networks over time. And that is achievable. And look, I think the whole paradigm for software engineers and developers and the user experience side of this is still quite early as well. So that's just sort of looking back in my own experience in sort of the maturation of platform software and developer experience and user experience. We're not quite there. And I would agree, though, that we're getting darn close, right? But in my mind, even if you get to a paradigm, let's say you have a blockchain that like really clicks, like we're still going to end up with kind of layers above that that proliferate the number of networks that are out there. And so I do think we'll have a period of time where, you know, there's this concept of like an app chain, which is like, you know, if I'm, let's say I'm some large Asian internet company and I have 500 million users on my app and I want to start using digital tokens and stable coins and smart contracts, like, and I open that up to my end users, like everything in the market today would just collapse. It can't support that. But you can imagine a world where you have almost like virtual private clouds in AWS. You have kind of like these spun up infrastructures that are spun up as kind of these kind of connected blockchains, network of networks type models that support this scaling. And, you know, basically like all of that is sort of fragmentation and more infrastructure development. And we want to make sure as Circle that our stablecoin network protocols, which is USDC, ERC, CCTP, other things that we're building in terms of like gas fee abstraction, there's a lot of stuff we're building, that all of that is sort of abstracted away for users and developers. And we're going to continue to support the new ecosystems that come. So whether it's 15 or 50, I can't give you an exact number, but what I can say is we are continuing to build and deploy and launch our stablecoin network infrastructure on more blockchain networks. And I don't know when that, you know, kind of reaches its iPhone moment or reaches the point of diminishing returns. I don't know. In terms of the question around currencies, we've obviously launched USDC and EURC. And I can't say, you know, we're not going to launch other currencies, but what I would say is we're seeing all around the world, whether it's in emerging markets or developed markets, we are seeing, because stablecoin laws are coming into effect, we're seeing high quality stablecoin projects coming online in a ton of different places around the world. And so I think like 2025 will be a year where you see high quality, you know, peso stablecoins and, you know, yen stablecoins and Aussie dollar stablecoins and pound sterling stablecoins. You're going to see more of these. We don't need to be the issuer of all of these different foreign currency stablecoins. What we need, though, is we need quality regulated firms that can build on the same kind of infrastructure that we've built up so that you have like really good interoperability and so that the applications can be built that can use all of these really easily. And so that's something that we're quite excited about. We've published a lot about on-chain FX and what that could look like. And you know, we're excited about the potential growth in additional currency stablecoins. But right now we're quite content with dollars and euro as Circle products.
Why would you seed the Australian stablecoin market, the Japanese yen stablecoin market, the Swedish kroner stablecoin market to another company when you already have you have enough money, you have, you know, a great brand, you have experience, you already know the regulators to some degree? Why would you let, you know, Billy Bob or Jackie Jane in Australia come up with the, what would that be like?
AUDC.
AUDC, thank you.
I mean, look, you know, there's like focus is one thing. Like we have to be focused. You know, I think every one of these is complex. There's complex legal and regulatory issues. the local preferences of, say, the central bank and other things play a role. And, you know, we sort of think about, like, what's the market size? You know, how big of a market is this? Coming back to some of the discussion we had earlier, like, we genuinely believe that, you know, the role of the dollar, in particular in this age of an internet financial system, is going to grow. And you know, I think it will be the biggest. And so we want to, you know, obviously keep a lot of our energy focused there while also enabling those kind of connection points and on and off ramps in markets around the world. And so we want to encourage that development. And I think we are encouraged by the developments that are happening. But we don't feel compelled that from a kind of business or ecosystem perspective, that's something that we have to do.
And you can always buy them later. You know, if someone does all the work of building an AUSDC, and, you know, they're not going to become as big as a company doing USDC because there's fewer Australian dollars out there in demand. You can always just snap them up later. Who doesn't love a little tech company M&A? You know, well, apart from Linacon, but different topic. All right. So I went back in time and looked at the data from USDC's circulation, its market cap, if you will. It was, at the start of 2020, about $500 million, which was less than I actually kind of remembered. By the end of 2021, it was $42.5 billion. Today, it's in the $34, $35 billion range. But a huge growth in USDC circulation during a time in which interest rates were doing interesting things. I made you a graphic, Jeremy.
I have lots of graphics. I have lots of charts.
Well, this is one I made just for you. And you can tell that I made it because it's the ugliest thing you've ever seen. But this is the federal funds rate. As you can see, coronavirus time, it went down to zero, rose very quickly. The company, as I understand it, does better when money has more value because you're sitting on lots of reserves. Is that a fair statement?
Not necessarily. No. Okay. I think if you think about, like, monetary theory and from both a central bank perspective and from a, say, a bank perspective, there's sort of this idea of a neutral interest rate, and there's sort of the zero lower bound that we lived with for a while after the great financial crisis and monetization of government debt and other things. And then you had, obviously, like, this sort of shock response to sharp inflation and sort of a monetary tightening. And we have these cycles, obviously, where you have kind of changes. But, like, the kind of nominal interest rates and or kind of neutral interest rates and where those land, I think broadly, that concept of a neutral interest rate, which some people today think might be around 3% or 2.75% or something like that, where it's sort of neither restrictive nor easing, right, is potentially, like, the ideal state. And so when you're a central bank or a bank itself, like, high interest rates are not great. Like, there might be some incremental income from sort of reserves or deposits in a bank's case that comes from that. It's a restrictive environment. There's less economic activity. There's less money velocity in the economy. There's less invested capital. And so when interest rates go down, yes, the actual, like, reserve income that we may receive on a unit basis may go down. That is just factually true and obvious, right? But at the same time, when the price of money gets cheaper, money velocity picks up. And capital investment picks up, and economic velocity picks up. And that's reflected in both risk capital in terms of, like, investment in markets, but it's also affected in the real economy. The goal of that declining interest rate is to continue to get in real investment in the real economy. And those are supportive of a growth of a stablecoin. We've been through different cycles. We've been through an easy cycle. We've been through a restrictive cycle. And so now we're going to learn what a more moderate or cycle looks like. Maybe, like, no one can predict the future. But I think our view is that, you have kind of multiple forces. You have these macro forces that we don't control, which is just, like, what the economy is doing and how central banks are responding. Like, we have nothing to do with that. On the other hand, we have a platform, a network, and we have user flywheels, developer flywheels. We're building this very high utility form of digital money. We're building this really powerful developer platform that has its own intrinsic growth dynamics to it. And I believe when you think about the total addressable market of legal electronic money today, which is on a global basis over $100 trillion, like I believe that the portion of that legal electronic money pie, the portion of that that is sort of dollar stablecoins and euro stablecoins or sort of stablecoins is going to grow. It will grow over time, whatever the interest rate is, right? And so this is why I look at this and say, hey, we're in the really early days here. We're talking about only $160 billion out of $100 trillion that are in stablecoins today. So we're super early. And if you think that like internet scale utility, what it did for media or communications or for transportation or software distribution, if you think that internet money and this kind of thing can be as transformative as those other things, like we might see a world in 10 or 15 or 20 years where 10% of the world is in something like this. Like that's actually like when you think about internet markets and their growth, like 10% takes decades to get to that. But in the next 1 to 2 decades, I do think we could see a world where 10% of money is like stablecoin money. And that would be extraordinary. And, you know, we hope to be an important part of it.
Okay, so let's bring that chart back up and put what you just said against this, because I think it's actually very illustrative of the dynamics at play here. So if you're watching the video of this, I added some arrows. Green is when the Fed's raising rates, red's when they're going down. And then the blue dots are different financial moments from Circle. The first blue dot is the initial SPAC filing. And then the second blue dot is the repricing of the SPAC. And then the third blue dot is the end of the SPAC. And then the fourth blue dot is the company announcing earlier this year that it has filed privately to go public. And you might be surprised, given the relationship between holding reserves and interest rates, higher rates, hold reserves, more money, that Circle was putting together a SPAC deal when rates were zero. But to Jeremy's point, economic activity at that point was so high, stablecoins were enjoying their first peak, if you will, in the 2021 era. So it sounds, Jeremy, like money was inexpensive, things were very active. That was great for Circle because everyone was buying stablecoins. And now when rates are higher, you might make more money in the short term. But if you want to grow the pie as much as you can in the longer term, more economic activity is better than more near-term cash flow. Ergo, lower rates could yield a bigger company down the road.
I think it's a good conceptual model. I think it's that is exactly the right conceptual model.
Okay. So in that case, then I was going to ask you, rates are going to go down soon. Are you concerned? But it sounds more like you would frame that as a very short term or near term.
My view, my view has been for, quite some time now, that rates need to come down. It's critical that rates need to come down because I think it is ultimately we need to ensure that there's a healthy economic environment and so I've been of that view for some time, and I think the market's been of that view as well. I mean, yes. The markets obviously banks, stablecoin issuers like Circle, I think we're all of the view that, we need to see lower rates to sustain the economy and to create an environment that is a better environment for entrepreneurs, a better environment for small businesses, a better environment for large companies, a better environment for capital that needs to be invested, for growth, for long-term growth. When you have more money at rest and you have more money on the sidelines and you have people who don't want to take risk, which is how economic growth happens. People take risk. They sort of say, hey, I want to build a new factory. I want to open a new restaurant. I want to hire more employees. Like we want to encourage that, and lower interest rates are really critical to that. And I think also really important to the growth of the internet financial system.
Yeah. It's interesting how much this feels like we're having a quasi-central banking conversation, even though we're not, because Circle sits in such like the center of an economic web of different entities that we have to talk about secondary effects and so forth.
We do.
I wish we had like 2 more hours to just riff about the future of money and so forth, but we don't. I do want to look ahead though a little bit. We've talked about regulations around the world, and I saw you guys had a slickly produced hero video of you talking about regulations and coffee and purchasing and so forth. Audio quality was fantastic. 10 points to your engineers for nailing that. But what is the state of regulations here in the US, and how optimistic are you that we are not going to fumble the bag, as it were?
Yeah, I remain very optimistic about it. And you know, look, we're now like in the thick of a presidential election cycle. And so kind of, you know, all bets are off for the next 8 weeks or whatever it is for anything happening in anything. So obviously a lot of the attention is on sort of what are going to be the policy agendas of either, you know, a Trump or a Harris administration and all that jazz. But I think there's been a huge amount of work in the United States with multiple stakeholders on payment stablecoin, the Payment Stablecoin Act, which is sort of, in my view, in a fairly mature state, bipartisanship in the House. And I think also from Senate leadership, I think we've seen great engagement from the administration, the White House, the Treasury Department, the Fed. And it's something that has been set as a priority by the administration to get done for a couple of years. And I think a lot of the kind of key things that needed to be thought through and how to do this in a way which supports private sector innovation, the kind of safety and soundness characteristics that are necessary, making sure that the Fed plays an important role, in fact, a critical role in establishing the standards for what dollar stablecoins are, but also giving a pathway to, you know, state-based issuers and regulators, sort of like the dual banking system today. You could be a state chartered bank or a federally chartered bank. So creating a kind of model for that. And, there's been a huge amount of work, and I'm quite confident that we will see Payment Stablecoin Act become law. I'm not a prognosticator on that, but it seems like everyone wants to see that happen. And it's still possible that could happen inside of this Congress, potentially in the lame duck session. That all depends on, you know, presidential election outcomes. And but this is, you know, even Maxine Waters just said publicly, I think in the last week, like if she were to be chair of the committee, if they won the House on the Democratic side, like this is on, you know, top of her list. So, or near the top of her list, you know, frankly, it's the top of the list for Patrick McHenry and the Republicans as well. So I think, you know, you're seeing a lot of desire to get that done.
So let's say that Circle goes public. And forget all the details that are off, just assume public for a second. And the government shows up and starts buying shares because you're buying their debt, you're doing their digital currency for them, essentially. And they start buying shares in the company. Would that make you comfortable or uncomfortable?
Yeah, I've never given a thought to that. I don't know if governments really even do that. Like I have no idea. So
they don't is the answer to that question. But I think you guys are such an interesting company that's working with such an interesting currency and the potential to become so large that I think we're going to ask new questions down the road. This is a 5 or 10 year point, to be clear. But there's so much interesting stuff that could come as like a public-private partnership, if you will, between governments, currencies, and stablecoin providers. Like I can see the Australian government supporting a private company that was...
Yeah. I mean, look, the financial system is highly regulated, and it's sort of like the energy system is highly regulated. Our transportation systems are highly regulated. Our space travel systems are highly regulated. The production of medicines are highly regulated. Like most technologies and significant infrastructure in society are highly regulated. Like the software industry has sort of had an epoch of like 30 years where it was not highly regulated. But now, if you're doing anything really big and really interesting with software, whether it's AI or, you know, you're applying it with hardware and self-driving cars, or you're building a global digital currency system or whatever it is, like if you're doing things that kind of intersect into these kind of highly regulated spaces that have these really big impacts on society, that makes sense. Like I'm not of the view like, hey, like this is, you know, if it becomes really important to society and there are particular kind of covenants and like a social contract that needs to be in place around what you do and whatnot. Like that is what exists today. And so there are different levels of regulation. There's sort of very light regulation, there's heavier regulation. And, you know, we have like global systemically important banks, and those are more highly regulated than, you know, the Wichita Community Bank or whatever it is, right? You know, so if what we're building, you know, becomes, you know, systemically important or what have you, then we're going to have a different relationship with not just the US government, but other governments as well. These are way off in the future things, because this is definitely not that today. We're nowhere close to that. But what we're focused on is, obviously, we have a vision for what an internet financial system can look like. We have a vision for what open, programmable, composable money can bring to the world, and the innovation of that and the open internet and what that makes possible. And we want to make sure that that can come to life and not be stifled, and that does require policymakers and governments to actually create more degrees of freedom for innovation to happen, as has happened in other major areas of the internet.
I tried to frame the question in the most neutral or positive way possible, because I was trying to get away from what the Chinese government does with golden shares and so forth, and more like the government might want to be a partner in more ways than one in that question. But I agree, we're a long ways out. Okay, before I let you go, you guys filed privately to go public. As you and I both know, we're staring down the last couple of weeks before an election. And I'm presuming that you guys won't be pulling the trigger before the election. What can you tell us about the vibe about when you guys might decide to list?
Yeah, I can't comment on any open, you know, regulatory filings or matters. There's one thing I can say, which is that, you know, we are very committed to being a U.S. listed, publicly traded company. And a big part of our success as a company has to do with the trust and transparency that we have, that we've provided in what we do, and that we believe that if you're facing USDC as a user or as a business or as a financial company, and you know, you want that trust and transparency, and being held to the standards of US public company standards, the transparency, the accountability, the governance, the ethics, all of that is very important to continuing to build on what we've already done. And so we're committed to that. And we believe it's a really important step for us as a company.
Oh, I agree with all that. I think going public is a great thing. I don't know why it became, business persona non grata amongst a lot of unicorns today, but I think it's great. Transparency, shared upside in the public, just everyone gets a bit more visibility. And I think it's great, especially for companies like Circle. So we will talk to you again in and around IPO time. We'll see when that is. But Jeremy, thank you so much for dropping by Twist yet again. As always, I learned quite a lot. We appreciate it. If you're not following us on your podcasting platforms, do that. We're on YouTube. We go live. We have lots of fun. My name is Alex. We'll see you guys soon. Goodbye.